This was painful 2 years ago.
This is too bad we didn't do it.
Okay, we will call this committee meeting to order. This is the Thursday, March 19th, 2015 hearing of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. Members, we have two items on the agenda, just small technical bills, non-controversial. So we'll start with Senate File 224, Senator Champion. This is a bill we've considered in a previous biennium. Welcome, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee, and thank you to all those who are here and all the folks that have been working very hard on this important piece of public policy. Thank you for considering Senate File 224. I think it's always important, and I know the time is always of the essence, so I'll try to be as brief but as eloquent as possible.
Senator Champion, 1 second. A quorum is present.
Thank you. I'd like to always start off with why. Why Senate File 224? I think it's because it's a public safety issue and affects all of us. It creates safer roads. I like this bill to be known as Driver's License for All, right? I think it's a public safety issue and it affects all of us. It creates safer roads. It increases the number of insured drivers because you can't get any insurance if you don't have a license. It decreases the number of car accidents. It protects the civil rights of all of our residents. It creates family stability because so many of our families need transportation for work or for school or to take kids back and forth to soccer practice or whatever it might be. And we want to promote families being able to stay together. And it promotes integration and collaboration between the immigrant community and local governments. And almost 80% of Minnesotans drive alone to get to work. And I sort of talked about that earlier. And we know that this bill will affect so many people, but especially our Latino buying community. And I have a stat from 2010 that says that the Latino buying power in Minnesota totaled $5.1 billion, right? And so, and there's many of Latino-owned businesses had sales and receipts of $1.6 billion and employed 5,970 people in Minnesota. And if all unauthorized immigrants were removed from Minnesota, the state would lose $4.4 billion in economic activity and over $2 billion in gross state product and approximately a little less than 25,000 jobs. So we all win. Businesses will be better equipped to recruit and retain workers. Workers will have the ability to access and get the jobs, and we can help to create financial stability to our communities of color. And so as we look at our future, and I know we've been hearing a lot about Minnesota, you know, getting browner and grayer. And so as baby boomers retire, immigrants will increasingly be critical for continued economic growth and ensuring a steady flow of new workers. And so the U.S. needs new taxpayers to help fund Social Security and Medicare and new workers to fill retiree positions and provide health care services. So driver's license for all. This is a bill that increasingly becomes more and more important because I've been hearing a lot of folks around these corridors talk about the importance of our roads and not just the infrastructure, but to make sure that people who are using our roads have the ability to have insurance and be safe. And so this bill, as you heard before, and that's why I'm sort of going through it quickly because this is not the first time that this committee has heard this particular bill, but the only change that it does is that it will modify the driver's license license procedure to allow an official form of government identification, i.e. a passport, issued by a country other than the United States to be used as a primary document to apply for a driver's license. And in your document, you might have a little error there, but it should be Senate File 224 would ensure that all drivers from Minnesota can operate a vehicle safely and have an official identification issued by our state. And so this public policy will protect public safety and strengthen the work law enforcement does with the immigrant community. So everyone will still have to go through the same process of being identified and also providing a source of identification that would be verified, and so there's nothing that would be problematic because the person who is applying is a person who would be proven as far as their identity. They still would have to do testing, right? So we think it's always important for people to get a permit and get behind the wheel and do all the training necessary. And if you do those two things, then you can get a Minnesota driver's license. And if we want more details about the proof of identity, I do have some other folks here from the Mexican consulate and from other sources. And also you'll hear from Pat McCormick or someone from their office to talk about that identification process because we understand that that's something that we always want to make sure that we do is make sure that we identify folks. But also what's important is that prior to 2003, this bill or the essence of it was already in place. You know, people could come and verify their presence and be able to get a driver's license. So when you think in terms of this modification, the bill will allow, as I said earlier, a government identification issued by a country other than the United States to be used as a primary document to apply for a driver's license. So they still have to provide their full name and date of birth of the cardholder, a photograph identifying the cardholder, a unique identification number, and security features that makes the card challenging for someone to alter in any shape, form, or fashion. And so there would be this design and the quality in order to make sure that the material and technology is there and not readily available to the general public. So it has those protection features. And as I said earlier, testing will still be there. But more than anything, if someone's able to get a driver's license, by going through the necessary steps that I've already articulated, the impact will be, as I mentioned earlier, we would ensure that all drivers from Minnesota can operate a vehicle safely and have an official form of identification issued by our state. And this public policy will protect public safety and strengthen the work law enforcement does with the immigrant community. Safer roads, increased number of insured drivers, and on and on and on. You also see in your packet the other thing that the amendment that I'm going to introduce in a second is going to do is one, it just talks about defining the driving card. It also provides a fee that has to be paid. This particular card would be its own separate card. It would have unique features, needless to say, but there would be a fee, as I mentioned, that the applicant would have to pay. And then there would be one additional feature because many years ago, 2 years ago, one of the main concerns that individuals articulated was they wanted to make sure that a person couldn't use this identification for anything other than driving.
So it Senator Champion will have the amendment you're speaking to distributed while you're describing
yes.
it. This is the A1 amendment.
That is the A1 amendment.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what would happen is there would be this notification. Before I propose that the notification be put on the front of the card, and I'd also put in your packets a sample that was given before, right? But now, this year, I'm proposing, unless something else is put forward, is for the language for driving only be on the back. So if you look at your last sheet of paper, and or you could even look at your own driver's license if you have it with you. If you turn your driver's license over, you will see something that says restrictions. It's already there. On mine, guess what it says? Corrective lenses, because I need to make sure that I have my glasses on if I'm going to get behind the wheel. If I don't, you know the rest, okay? But in this instance, where it says restriction, any of those other things would apply, but it would say for driving only. We think that's important in order for folks to know that it's only for driving and cannot be used for any other purpose. So I think I've covered everything as briefly and as succinctly as possible. So right now I would like to offer the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair. And I did kind of go through it in my description.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Champion. Senator Kent, that's all right, offers the A1 amendment. That's the author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries.
And with that being said, Mr. Chair, I'd love to have Pat McCormick from the Department of Public Safety, and she has another person with her to come up and answer any questions or provide some testimony about the impact that this particular bill will have and if it presents any challenges or not.
Welcome, Ms. McCormick and Ms. Kopczynski.
Thank Whoever you, would like Chair. To proceed. Members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services.
Joan Kopczynski, Driver Services Director.
We'd be happy to respond to any questions that you may have. I don't think we have any statements that we would like to make, but we're certainly here to provide any information that you would need.
Great. Thank you. Questions, members? All right.
Chair.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, Senator Champion described this as a new card. Can you explain what's new and different about it?
You want to see that, or you want to see the language?
It's
Class D, I think, is what we're proposing.
So the difference in
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senator Pratt, the difference in this
Ms. McCormick,
card is that...
Ms. McCormick, can you pull the microphone a little closer? I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Yeah, the mics are really, they're not good in this room.
Okay, sorry about that. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. So as you can see on the backs of these cards, there is, you can see the current card at the top, and then the second one would, under restrictions in red, it would say driving privilege only, which would mean that card would not be allowed to be used for identification purposes. So that's the major difference in the card. Joan, did you want to add anything? I think so.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. McCormick, it's really not a different card. It's just a different restriction, correct?
It's a Class D.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, it's a Class D license, but it does have a restriction that it's only for driving, and so it wouldn't be able to be used for identification.
Thank Senator you, Mr. Pratt. Chair. But again, there's nothing different about the plastic. There's nothing different about the security features. It's essentially the same card.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, that's correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Pratt.
I'd like to offer an amendment to the A1 if I could.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to modify the A1. And I'm trying to find the line here real quick. I lost track of it. On line 3.7, following for driving only on the back of the card, replace that to for driving only on the front of the card.
Hang on a sec. We're in the middle of a motion. I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
It's just on line 3.7, just changing on the back of the card to on the front of the card.
So change the word back to front.
Yes.
So you want the same change on 311?
So Mr. Senator Pratt, would you want the same change on line 311? The ID card.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I think that's fine.
Okay. All right. Never mind. All right, Senator Champion, how do you respond to Senator Pratt's amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Pratt, for your discussion and your proposal. But at this particular time, I am going to ask the committee not to make that change right now. There might be the possibility of us talking about that, but right now we would like to keep it the way it is right now.
Okay. Anything further, members? Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Chair Dillon. Just to that point, Senator Champion, I know you talked about when we visited this in 2013, that's the way it was. And so now you're making the change, and I'm sure you've got a reason for why you're doing that, and maybe you could just share that with the committee.
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Reiner, one of the reasons is, of course, is because we've been talking to the other body. I shouldn't say that word, right? The other body.
Other people in this building.
And so there's a lot of different people that have been talking about this, and so I want to make sure that as it goes through the process that we continue to get the buy-in that we all need. We think that the change, as is articulated here, still provides the same level of security and trust and information so that it's the same outcome whether it's on the front or the back. Law enforcement and others will be trained in order to know what to look for, as they always do whenever they get this particular type of card. They can run it like anything else, and they'll know exactly what can or cannot happen with this particular card. And so I'll continue to talk to Senator Pratt about it, and so that we can, you know, try to find some common ground. But for right now, I would prefer for it to stay on the back of the card as opposed to the front of the card.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Anything further? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Reinert's exactly right. It's to bring it in full conformance with where we were in 2013. I trust that law enforcement will know to look at the back. I'm more worried about other people when we present our driver's licenses for multiple occasions. I do appreciate in your bill that you've got the election judge training carried over, and I'm sure as part of that, our election judges would know to turn it over on the back. But making sure that it's clear that the state ID card, it's clear you can't drive with that, and if you hand it to somebody, it's different enough that you would know. But with this, I think there's something about it. I think we need to get back to that 2013 area where it's clear and distinctive. So I hope the committee accepts my amendment to bring this back into conformity with the work that this committee did and approved it 2 years ago.
Okay. We have a motion before us. Anything further, members? All in favor of Senator Pratt's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. Anything further, Senator Champion or members?
Mr. Chair, we just have a couple more testifiers, and we'll, again, move expeditiously. But while the other testifiers are coming, I would like to have Maria.
Ms. McCormick, Senator Peterson has a question for you before you depart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, or Ms. McCormick. In reviewing the fiscal note here, if I'm reading that correctly, you're anticipating to produce 32,000 new cards. Is that accurate? Or?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, yes, that's basically the people that have a status check on their card right now. That was the estimate that we used, because that was the only estimate we would be able to have in terms of people that are here on a temporary basis and would have to have a new card without status check on the license, because that's what the bill also eliminates, those regulations that require a status check on a license for someone who's here on for a temporary reason on a visa.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Champion or Ms. McCormick, so what happens if if that comes in significantly higher? Then that tells us that there was just more people here that had not been under the status check.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I think, well, we would certainly have to change. We would have to ask for additional appropriation authority from our driver services special revenue account if we needed it. Otherwise, we might have enough money that we would be able to do it with our current funding. It's hard to tell, because that was the only finite number we could really use at the current time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator
Peterson.
Senator Champion, from your perspective in authoring this bill, are the advocates telling you that 32,000 driver's license, is that an accurate number, or is that high, or is that low, or?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Champion.
And Senator, from what I'm hearing, it may be high, but again, we don't know. But we believe that this is a good foundational number, and this still will provide an opportunity for us to go forward and also revisit some of these issues, even in finance as well.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Peterson.
Ms. McCormick, just I think it was last week or the week before, we had an extensive discussion in regards to adding our insurance number. I'm trying to think what else. I don't recall exactly else, but we were asking for our residents to bring all their insurance card information with them. And I don't recall seeing a fiscal note on that. Was there a fiscal note, or was that something the department was absorbing?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I don't recollect what that fiscal note is, so I'll have to get back to the committee. We do a lot of fiscal notes, and right now we're really doing a lot of fiscal notes, and so I'll be glad to send that information to the committee, and so that you'll have that information. I'll get it to you by tomorrow morning.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, Ms. McCormick, would you be revising that note to include this 32,000 number then? Because I would guess that this number was not in your original fiscal note for that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, yes, we would have to make an estimate to include that as well.
Okay. And last question I have, Mr. Chair, Ms. McCormick, or Senator Champion, is there actually a penalty? I'm not even sure. In Minnesota, do we have a penalty for providing a false address if somebody were coming in and providing the address that turns out to not be accurate? Is there a penalty for that, or is there a penalty for the for example, if we find out the insurance information is not accurate in this previous bill we had, is there a penalty for that?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, that would be a revocation of the driver's license or the ID card.
Ms. Kupchinski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, upon conviction, the driving privileges are revoked or suspended depending on the circumstances for an insurance violation. Again, the same would apply for false address. We would need a conviction before any action would be taken against driving privileges.
Okay.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, or Ms. McCormick, who actually enforces that then? Is that something that's discovered, for example, through a routine stop, and then or how would that be discovered?
Ms. Kupchinski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, the insurance portion of that revocation or suspension could be discovered in several different ways, including an accident and not having insurance at the time of an accident. Again, it would all be done through law enforcement, through a discovery process. Same would apply for if someone was stopped and did not have the correct address on their license, and the officer pursued it and wrote the violation, there would need to be a conviction for it to be part of the driving record.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Champion,
if Senator Peterson has additional questions about law enforcement, we do have representatives here from law enforcement. We have a representative from the Minneapolis Police Department, as well as the senior commander from the St. Paul Police Department.
Yep, no further questions. Yeah.
Thank you. Anything further? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also have a question for both Senator Champion and for Ms. McCormick. May also need to add some. I'm noticing a repealer here, so I took a look at the repealer language, which seems to be exclusively removing the proof of residency. And this is something that was previously in rule, I believe. So could you please explain why or what's happening here with repealing residency?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, that is the rule that we currently have in place, and this bill eliminates these rules, and so that's why it's at the end as being repealed, because that's what the legislation says, that this would not come into play if under this new legislation, and that has to do with the status check.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Senator Champion just explain his rationale behind repealing the residency.
Senator Kiffmeyer, this is residency as understood differently than simply where you reside. It's not about your address per se, if that's the question you have. But Senator Champion, you do have to still prove that.
Absolutely.
You live somewhere and you have an address. This is about your status with respect to citizenship. So I'm sorry, Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, what we are repealing, well, first of all, globally, let me just say, a person still has to prove their identity. They have to prove where they live, the whole nine yards. This, what my bill does is allows for proof of identity to also be used by way of another primary source that doesn't necessarily just have to be a U.S. government-issued source. So that's why there's the necessary repealer for the proof of residency and the proof of residency under the rules, 7410.0410, right? And so that's what it does. And then it also repeals the other fee structure there, because we do have a fee there that is articulated in our bill. And again, this is for status checks and the other immigrant-related sort of notions. So if someone was here, be it documented or undocumented, there were certain procedures that they had to take in order to receive a driver's license. And if you're undocumented, obviously, and if you don't have a current passport from our great country, then now we provide an opportunity for our country to recognize a passport from another great country.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, so these are the rules for to allow for legal presence of someone who is here on a visa or for some temporary purpose. Those are the rules that are repealed in this legislation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I
Senator
see...
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. What I see here is that, you know, we're repealing a lot of pages about the proof of residency, two full pages here, and a lot of other language as well, but it's replaced by page 1, line 24, just a space where the applicant must attest to a resident address in Minnesota. So it's no proof, just an attestation. But there's also other language that is removed as well. Some of the warning notice of possible cancellation and so on and so forth. So I am just a bit puzzled as to all the elimination of this language, almost three pages worth, that goes with it. So it seems to go quite a bit above and beyond.
Mr. Chair, and to Senator Kiffmeyer, it actually doesn't go above and beyond, because this new license would replace the need to have this other information. So, for an example, there is, and Ms. McCormick can chime in here if I'm saying something that is incorrect, but when you even think in terms of lawful short-term admission status, there would be no longer a need for that section, because we would have this new license that would encompass and include those individuals. And then perhaps Senate Counsel can assist if there's something else that I'm missing.
So I just need to confirm, pardon me, Senator Champion, if you said this, on line 1.24 and 1.25, where it says contain a space where the applicant must attest to a resident address in Minnesota, that's current practice as a function of rule, which we all have to comply with.
Absolutely.
And in fact, I don't think any of us who applies for a driver's license has a higher standard of proof as to what our address is, other than filling it out in a form and saying this is true. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So this is basically current practice, current law to which we are all subject. We're just simply putting it in statute versus rule.
Senator Dibble, that is correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, so then would the current law also apply? We have a 30-day requirement that if an address changes, they have to update their license to their new address. I would be assuming all of those things would apply as well.
Senator Champion or Ms. McCormick or Ms. Kupchinski. Ms. Kupchinski has her finger up. Ms. Kupchinski, all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the issue of changing the address within 30 days, that's under statute 17111 that requires that. There is no change to that proposed.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, just for the record, the residency basically is our residency requirement is that we mail the license to the residents, and that's how we are able to affirm that someone is at that particular address.
All right.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Can you just let me know then what happens? I'm familiar with some other cases where you mail that out. What if it comes back to you? What happens then?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, we keep those licenses because oftentimes we get people that are wondering what happened to their license, and so we have them filed, and then we are able to check through that to ensure that they may need to come in and change their address, or there may have been an error on our part, so we keep them. I'm going to turn to Ms. Kupchinski in terms of for the length of time that we keep them.
Ms. Kupchinski.
Mr. Chair, the licenses are kept for 90 days. With the assumption that an individual who is waiting for a card would contact us within those 90 days and ask why the card hasn't been received. We can check the application. We can check the card. Sometimes it's as simple as an apartment number and the person's name is not listed on the mailbox, and the post office will return them for that. There's no error in the card. There's no error on the application. So that's just an example of how they're returned and what we do, what the process is when they're returned.
Right. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Anything further, members? I'm sorry, yeah. Senator Peterson. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion, follow up on some of a thought came to my mind in regards to Senator Kiffmeyer's questions. Would you anticipate people coming to Minnesota to get a driver's license and then using that in other states that don't live here?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
And Senator, I don't anticipate that, as I believe that that this just creates an opportunity for law-abiding, family-oriented folks in order to get a driver's license. And pay insurance and understand our laws and be lawful. So I don't anticipate anyone coming from some other state and using our process illegally once this bill and if this bill is so honored to pass. As I don't think that we, when we pass other laws, do we stop to say, do we think that there's the possibility that someone else is going to come and take advantage of some other lawful notion that we put forward, right? And so, but we do have laws in place, as I'm sure those other states do, if someone is behaving unlawfully, if they're providing inaccurate information, if they're doing anything that law-abiding citizens, individuals don't do, there are always consequences for that conduct. So again, I believe that this is something that will provide safety and family stability and will allow us to go forward.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, in your research, it's your opinion that in other states that have done this, it's been their residents and there's been no move from people from outside of their state to come and get a license and use that for the purpose of driving in other states?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
Senator, I think you're asking me to read the minds of other people to some degree. And the reason why I'm saying that is, first of all, let's be very clear that the process that we've articulated here is not new to the state of Minnesota. We didn't make the change because we had an overwhelming number of people coming to our state, getting a license illegally and going to some other location. Not at all. And so with that being said, I believe that anyone who wants to find a way to commit a crime will do that, not necessarily driven by this particular bill. It's sort of like young people sometimes who get a fake ID when they're 18 and their fake ID says they're 21. I don't think that will stop us from issuing valid license to individuals. And I'm not suggesting by any stretch of the imagination that this is a process that's going to be much more lucrative or favorable to someone who doesn't want to do the right thing.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Senator McCormick, in your research or in regards to this issue, have you had any colleagues in other states that manage motor vehicle departments? Have they seen residents come from other states to get licenses in their state to be used other places?
Mr. Chair and
Ms. McCormick.
Senator Peterson, I can't say that I have heard that specifically. I think there are always going to be challenges when you change your regulations related to driver's licenses in terms of ensuring that you are addressing concerns that you may not have thought about before implementing it, but I have not heard that that is a major concern in the states that I've discussed it with, which include Illinois and New Mexico are the two that I've talked to. I don't know, Joan, if you've heard anything else. But.
Mr. Chair, no, I have not.
Great, thank you.
All right. All right. Anything? Oh, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion, and I apologize. When I first read your amendment, I thought it was a delete also. But Senator Kiffmeyer kind of got me along this line of thinking. Where in your bill, we're repealing a number of sections in Rule 7410.0410. Ms. McCormick, can you talk about what those repealers are?
Ms. McCormick.
Is this over here on this side? Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, the first rule, 7410.0400, talks about the fact that a driver license applicant has to have a Minnesota address on the DL or ID application. As we said previously, that is how we are able to verify that they have a residence in Minnesota. 7410.0400, the DL or ID may only be issued to someone that has a Minnesota, with a Minnesota address. And they can only have one residence at a time.
Just for the record, Ms. McCormick, 7410.0410. You said 0400.
Okay.
Oh, did I misspeak?
Okay.
Ms. McCormick did.
I'm sorry.
Yep.
So I'm sorry, you're looking at the third one down then?
Okay. Well, so I'm just looking at the repealer that repeals essentially all the subparts of 7410.0410, proof of residency.
Yes, and the Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, the 7410.0410 is also talks about the fact that you must attest to a Minnesota address on the application. And if you're applying for a duplicate that doesn't have a change of address, you still have to attest to the fact that you are at that address so that we have that as a record. As a result, when we mail the card out, if someone isn't at that address and it comes back, then that would mean that it wouldn't be a legal application.
And we put the new language on.
That's the new language.
Ms. McCormick, I think the parts I'm looking at are documents sufficient to prove residency, proof of residency. These were all repealers that were taken out of Senate File 271 2 years ago and have been added in now. I thought they were, again, I thought this was a delete all, Senator Champion, so I apologize for not addressing this with you earlier.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, again, if you look back at Senate File 224, lines 1.24 and lines 1.25, we put that language in there in order to make sure that there's a space where the applicant must attest to a residence address in Minnesota. So we made sure that that was there.
So, members, I'm not sure, but I think we continue to get confused between the words residence, your address, where you live, and residency, which is your legal status with respect to your presence in the United States. I just want to be sure we're clear on those distinctions. So, because the point of the bill, of course, in terms of these rules, repealers, that's the point of the bill. So folks who don't have what would be otherwise considered a lawful legal presence in the United States would otherwise be allowed to drive legally. That's the point of the bill. That's why these rules are being repealed. And in terms of establishing your address where you live, regardless of your residency status, your residence, nothing is changing other than that provision is being brought into statute versus rule. Is that clear? Senator Pratt.
Well, Mr. Chair, there are a significant, I mean, there are 14 different subparts of 7410.0410 that are being repealed. As we did it 2 years ago, it was simply adding a different section saying a government identification card means a valid unexpired passport by a country other than the United States with a certified birth certificate from another country other than the United States, on and on and on. And so we were able to keep some of these post 9/11 reforms in place 2 years ago simply by adding a simple statement or section rather than repealing a whole section of law. And so I'm simply looking at making a comparison between what passed this body 2 years ago and where we're at today. And we did some good work 2 years ago, Senator Champion, and I'm trying to get us back to that.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Champion,
and Senator Pratt, these are the same repealers, Senator Pratt. These are the same repealers, and that's why I made the necessary amendments in order to put it back into the place and space that it has always been. These are the same repealers. And so you and I can continue to have that discussion with Ms. McCormick and the others, and in the event that something is different or something was taken out that should not be, then there would be no problem with us having that discussion. But I would need you to be very clear on the fact that we are looking at the same bill. We're looking at the same process. We're looking at the same language. And I clearly articulated what the only difference was from my vantage point, which was the driving-only language to be on the back instead of the front. So if you want to continue to have that discussion, we are more than open to that, and we are at the same place with the repealers that we were 2 years ago.
I appreciate that, Senator Champion.
All right. Senator Kiffmeyer and then Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Senator Champion, it just always is hard when you've got a situation where you're repealing a lot of language and yet at the same time with less language saying it's doing the same thing. That's always a hard thing to comprehend, because even in this proof of residency, there is still the attestation of the resident's address. So the distinction is made already in what you are deleting. So I'm just puzzled as to why you would even delete that. So usually there's a reason for that. You don't just delete something for no reason. There is a reason for that. And so that was why the question. I mean, it's a legitimate question that we ask all the time of our presenters in a committee. So I just wanted to clarify that I have seen that in this repeal, and that's why it makes it even more puzzling.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if Senator Kiffmeyer wants a reaction, but I'll be happy to say this. I think we've tried many different ways to explain this, and even when I fell short in my articulation of why the change, I think our chair has done a good job of bifurcating the issue. One is residency, that is usually proven by saying that you are a citizen of the United States, and the other is resident. So because we are proposing in this legislation that for the resident, we are changing and saying that a person does not have to get a government-issued piece of ID that only that was only issued by the United States. We're saying that there's the possibility of proof of identity can be established by way of another verifiable security conscious country. That and so that's where the verification from the Mexican consulate and the whole nine yards can happen. The other aspect of this, when we think in terms of resident, is that they still have to attest, as you see on line 1.24 to 1.25, that you have to be a resident of the state of Minnesota. Ms. McCormick has also been very clear to say when someone comes in to get an ID, they have to, or a driver's license, they have to fill out the application, they have to demonstrate that they've done everything, and they send the card to the resident where a person resides. And in the event that the person if they're not there or for whatever reason, that card will come back to the state. They will hold on to that card for roughly 90 days. Within that period of time, a person can come in and say, hey, I didn't receive my card, and then they will do the necessary due diligence in order to understand what happened. So I would hope that we would understand that there's the residency that's based on proving if you are a citizen of the United States and getting a government-issued ID, as opposed to being a resident of the state of Minnesota. So in this bill, we're saying that proof of proving one's identity can happen in other ways as well.
Senator Peterson.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Senator Champion and Ms. McCormick, in conclusion, I'm concerned for you just because I was just reading an article here in the Denver Post that was dated in July 7th of last year. There was not 32,000 in Colorado. There was 150,000. In fact, their system shut down and crashed on July 1st. The first day that people could apply for these licenses. And you're telling us that this fiscal note is $17,000. You're not going to be hiring any staff for the DMV in Owatonna or St. Cloud or Monticello. And there's going to be lines, as in Denver, which I think is of similar size and population. There's going to be lines of hundreds of people, and so I'm concerned. And I would just encourage you as the head of that department to be ready and be prepared, because I think all of us are going to hear about that when that happens. And so I'm a little bit concerned on your testimony that you're not prepared for what's coming and what's happened just west of here in Colorado when a similar measure passed. So.
Well, that would explain the deputy registrar's endorsement of this bill.
Yeah.
It's a joke. Senator, Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, obviously we would need some time if this is the wish of the legislature and this bill passes and is enacted into law. Obviously we would need to have time to be able to plan for that. You're also talking about having to design another card and all and there's a great deal of details, and so I'm sorry if I gave you the impression that this would be in. This is. I've talked with other states, as I said, at various AMVA conferences, the American Association of Motor Vehicle administrators, and it takes a lot of planning, and it would take a lot of effort to be able to accomplish it. But the other states have had, certainly they've had some challenges, but certainly whatever is the will of the legislature and the governor, that would be what we would implement.
So Mr. Chair, I mean, as what I see here, it's January 1st of 2016. I mean, it's less than, by the time the session ends, it'll be 6 or 7 months. Senator Champion, is that enough time?
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, point of order, please.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. I noticed some flashes and stuff going on. Is it appropriate for pictures to be taken during the hearing?
Senator Pratt, people take pictures.
I know
all the time.
We have a rule
floor,
on the Senate floor.
Issue, but yeah, in committee rooms, it's not an issue. Okay. But if the flash is bothering you, we'll make note of that. If we have flash audience, please use your non-flash mode. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just going to answer Senator Peterson's question. Is that we believe that there's enough time.
Okay,
here,
thank you.
But in the event that we hear something different, I'm always willing to make the necessary adjustment.
All right. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is more of a statement that this was something that we've done in the past. So it's not something that the department's not done before. So any surprises? I mean, did we lose a bunch of people when we changed it in 2013 or whenever we changed the law within the department?
Oh, Senator Jensen, it didn't pass the Senate, but it didn't pass the House.
It used to be in effect, right? We used to issue these cards in the state of Minnesota.
But wasn't it that undocumented people could get it in?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen and members of the committee, we would have never issued a card like this as long as I've been in DVS. What we have done is we've had to ramp up to issue a brand new card because of a card design, and that it does take a lot of effort. And so that would certainly, we would have to evaluate it based on what the requirements were to determine if we needed a change in the effective dates.
Senator Jensen.
Oh, I just was under the impression that we had been issuing these in the past, and then it was changed at a certain point.
So
when was it repealed prior?
So that's what she's talking about, Ms. McCormick, is that there was a time, Mr. Chair,
When
we did issue license, my understanding, to undocumented folks prior to 2003, and it changed after 2003.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think what we're talking about is there was a rule that was in place where the I-99s, Joan, is that with the rule? There was a document that was just like a little pink slip of paper that you had to have, and so people would be able to replicate those, and so that rule was changed in 2003. I think that was the date. It may have been somewhere in the early 2000s, right after I started with DVS. And that was because there were people that were replicating it and just using that and having it look like it was an official signature from the immigration, and it wasn't. And so that was when we started looking at changes to the process in order to be able to verify people's identity and residency.
So probably the change, I'm just going to intuit, the change that occurred was the additional standards that were implemented and instituted as reflected in these rules.
Mr. Chair, that's right. Correct.
Okay. All right. Ms. McCormick, is there any potential savings to the department as a result of these rules being repealed and going to the standards that are articulated in Section 2 of Senator Champion's bill?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't think we've really actually talked about savings at this point in time. I don't know unless Ms. Kuczynski has some thoughts on the subject.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kuczynski.
I have no numbers or savings versus costs. We have not prepared that.
Well, I only ask because as I glance through, these 14 subparts, of which I think 12 or 13 are kind of fairly detailed processes that are spelled out for the agency to follow. I'm just wondering if, it's kind of elaborate and has all these different standards for your various different forms of legal presence in the United States. Just wondering if eliminating some, you don't have to answer this now. I think you're going to do a more intensive and in-depth analysis of the fiscal note based on some of these questions as this bill makes its way through the process. But that's just maybe something to analyze as you go forward. You don't have to respond now. All right. Anything further, members? Senator Senjum, then Senator Westrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, or perhaps anybody else in the audience, and I apologize if this question's been asked. I got in a little late. But is there anything that, relative to this bill, if we were to adopt this bill, is there any reason at all that we would need to have any concerns with whether or not the Minnesota driver's license continues to be a valid identification relative to the TSA and travel through airports across the country? Does this compromise our license in any way? Does the TSA have to approve driver's license states by states as valid IDs? Or maybe you get what I'm getting at.
Well, Senator Senjum, you actually are raising a whole other subject around real ID, which we're going to have to discuss before too long. Because our existing driver's license, I'll just say for a moment, our existing driver's license, as it is now for all of us, because we don't conform or comply to the Real ID standards, may not be sufficient in and of itself to board an airplane starting next year. It's already insufficient to enter some federal buildings and nuclear facilities and the like. So we're going to have to grapple with that before too long. That's a separate matter. I do believe that, as you're probably aware, Senator Champion's bill does provide for not allowing someone to board an airplane, but allow Senator Champion to respond.
Mr. Chair, it would be almost inconceivable to me that every TSA agent in America could know what a valid Minnesota license is and what it isn't, but that's just a comment. I mean, irrespective of the print on the back.
Right. Okay. Senator Champion.
So if I, Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, if I clearly understand your question, this particular license would have the restriction that it could only be used for driving purposes only, and that would be on the license itself as well. And so that would be clear, and therefore a person wouldn't be able to use it for any other purpose other than its intended purpose, which is just for driving.
Mr. Chair, and I didn't quite mean that. I understand, and I would trust that somebody had this would not use it in that fashion, but would, from a TSA perspective, would it affect the integrity of all licenses in Minnesota? In other words, might TSA say, you know what, they did something up in Minnesota, we don't agree with it, and thus we're not going to any further allow the Minnesota driver's license by anybody to be used as an ID point. And I guess it's not after the start of the year, but to be used as an ID for travel across the country.
Mr. Chair,
airline travel.
Senator Champion.
And Senator Senjum, from my understanding and research, no, there won't be a problem.
Other than Senator Senjum, there will be a problem next year for all of us.
For all of us.
With TSA. Yeah. And then that's just a fact. We have to deal with that. Anything further? Oh, I saw Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, the attestation that's required here, what's the process of that to walk us through what will they do? They'll sign a box or check a box?
Well, Senator Westrom, we did discuss this earlier. This is exactly what happens today for all of us. This is not a change for anyone who is applying for a driver's license. It's just simply being placed in statute. But I'll allow Senator Champion to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Westrom, again, the chair has been eloquent. You go to Driver Vehicle and Services. You complete an application. You have to provide the supporting documentation. If you use a primary source, then it's clear what you can use as a primary source. With this bill change, that primary source could include a passport that is not expired from another country that's been verified and has this verification, process. And so sometimes it's the one primary source and one secondary source. And then the person would also, have to demonstrate, obviously, that they have done the testing and everything that they need and pay a fee, right? And then once they pay their fee and if everything checks out and is verified, the driver's license will be then sent to that person's Minnesota residence.
Senator Champion, Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, based on what they've signed and attested to on the form?
Senator Champion.
Oh, there you go. I saw the chair was gone. I was like, hey, what happened? And so, Madam Chair, Senator Westrom, yes, and as well as providing the necessary documentation.
Okay. So, Ms. McCormick, let me ask you about this process. What's in place to avert any misrepresentation or fraudulent claim if somebody attests to one thing and it's not the case?
Ms. McCormick or
Ms. McCormick.
Ms. Gubchinsky?
Madam Chair and Senator Westrom, I'm going to ask Joan Kupczynski to respond. She's our Driver Services Director.
Okay. Ms. Kupczynski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Westrom, the process really doesn't change. The person attests to the address. The card is produced. The card is mailed to that address. If it's received, then that is proof of attest. That verifies the attestation of the residence. If the card is not deliverable, it comes back to our office for, as we stated earlier, for 90 days in hopes that the customer will contact us so that we can clarify what the issue is with the address, why they weren't able to receive it. It could be as simple as not having your name on an apartment, but that's how the department would verify the address of the individual.
And Senator Westrom, Mr. Chair, and Senator Champion, I would make a point out the bill we had through this committee a few meetings ago that didn't want to trust Minnesota residents, citizens, for proof of insurance, but this is the exact same process we're going through here, which is the process I was standing up for in that last bill. But if it's not good enough in that bill, I question if it's good enough in this bill.
Well, Senator Westrom, that was an attestation as well. You didn't have to bring in any documents. You simply had to write down your insurance company, the policy number, and the expiration date. You didn't need to actually prove it. That was an attestation as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I guess Senator Champion or to the department, if property has just a mailbox, a row of boxes, will the card get delivered to that mailbox, even though it might be down the block or a quarter mile away from the house and residence? That does that serve as a physical address?
Ms. Kupczynski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, the card is delivered to the location or the mailing. If it's, you know, if there are five boxes and it's up to the mail service to put it in the correct box, if that's what you're getting at. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Senator Westrom.
It is, and does, Mr. Chair, just to follow up briefly, post office box works as well then?
Mr. Chair, Senator
Kupczynski.
Westrom, no, post office box does not work.
Does not work, but if it's on the mail route at a mailbox, not necessarily on the property or the place of residence, then it works.
Mr.
Ms.
Chair,
Kupczynski.
That is correct, Senator Westrom.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe where Senator Westrom is going is in Minneapolis last election cycle, we had a number of voter registration cards at a central mail house, although the address of each of those boxes looked, in fact, like its own physical address. And so my question is, do you have a way of understanding that that is, in fact, the residential address of the person rather than and the physical address of the person rather than a drop site?
Ms. Kupczynski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, the department works very hard with the U.S. Postal Service. We also have software available where you can actually verify that an address is an address, not a mailbox for purchase. I'm trying to think. UPS has mailboxes. That is not an acceptable address. So we do have software that looks at that. We look at trends. We look at mailing addresses of perhaps, 15 cards being mailed to a certain location, I think, which is what you're referring to. And it's not – so, I mean, there are stopgap measures in place to prevent that. I can't promise that it's 100% foolproof, but we do have measures in place to try to prevent that.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Anything further, members? All right. Senator Champion, did you say you had a couple more people you wanted to have speak?
Yes, just briefly, Mr.
Right.
Chair. Maria Negregos? And she has an interpreter as well. And she's only going to provide little testimony.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Buenas tardes. Una disculpa por no hablarles en inglés, pero prefiero que el mensaje llegue claro.
Good afternoon. I apologize for not talking in English, but I prefer if you guys can clearly understand the message.
Buenas tardes, Senador Pratt. Mi nombre es María Negreros. Vivo en Shakopee y soy voluntaria con Isaías.
My name is María Negreros. I live in Shakopee and I'm a volunteer with Isaiah. I will be translating for Maria.
Para los que no me conocen, aparecí en la portada de Star Tribune la semana pasada.
For those of you that do not know me, I appeared in the first page of the Star Tribune last week.
So, como dije, mi nombre es María Negreros. Soy madre de dos hijos.
Like I said, my name is María Negreros. I am a mother of two children.
Soji de seis, Ethan de tres.
Sophie is 6 years old and Nathan is 3.
Ellos son la razón por la que estoy aquí en frente de ustedes.
They are the reason that I am here in front of you today.
Todos sabemos la importancia de la educación temprana en los niños.
We all know the importance of early education for children.
Leí un artículo del Washington Post que decía que los niños que atienden al preescolar les va mejor en comparación a los que se quedan en casa con familiares o con sus padres.
I read an article on the Washington Post that said that kids that start school early have more advantage than children that stay at home with their family and parents.
Según los estudios, casi el 90% del desarrollo del cerebro ocurre antes de los 5 años.
The study showed that 90% of the development of the children of the brain development occurs before they're 5 years old.
Es por eso que a los 3 años inscribí a mi hija en un programa de ECFE.
That is why when my daughter was 3, I enrolled her in a program,
ECFE. Y actualmente mi hijo, el menor, cursa un programa de Head Start.
And my son, the youngest, is on Head Start program.
Pero en Shakopee no hay transporte público para los preescolares.
But in Shakopee, they don't have public transportation for the preschoolers.
Igual que en la mayoría del estado.
That includes the majority of the state.
Es injusto para los padres de este bello estado.
It's unjust for the parents in this great state.
Donde la disparidad educativa entre las minorías y los blancos es la más grande en la nación.
Where the disparity in education between the minorities and Anglos is the biggest in the nation.
Como padres nos sentimos atrapados e inhabilitados para ayudar a nuestros hijos a desarrollar su potencial.
Like parents, we feel trapped without the ability to help our kids succeed.
El no tener licencia está afectando a nuestros hijos e impidiendo el crecimiento de una comunidad y el desarrollo de nuestro estado.
Not having a driver's license is affecting our kids and for them to develop.
Impidiendo el crecimiento.
Their growth.
De nuestra comunidad.
In our community.
Si decimos que la educación es un ecualizador, nuestros hijos no están ni van a estar al nivel de muchos.
If we say that education is an equalizer, then our kids will not be in the same level as other children.
La comunidad ha estado trabajando por años en este proyecto de ley.
The community has been working for years in this bill.
Y quisiera saber cuándo van a tomar esa decisión.
And I would like to know when that decision will be made.
¿Cuántos años más?
How many more years?
Me pregunto qué edad tendrán mis hijos cuando se pongan de acuerdo.
I ask myself how old my kids will be when finally that arrangement will be done.
Para la seguridad, la economía y el bienestar de las familias.
For security, the economy, and for the best for the families.
Nuestros hijos no solo son el futuro, pero también son el presente.
Our kids are not only the future, but they are also the present.
Y están viviendo una realidad injusta de desigualdad y desventaja.
And they're living a reality of injustice and disadvantage.
Cambiemos la ley juntos.
Let's change the law together.
Para que pueda prosperar nuestro estado.
So our state can prosper.
Nuestra economía.
Our economy can prosper.
Seamos una sociedad incluyente, no excluyente.
Let's be a society that's inclusive, not exclusive.
Porque así ganamos todos.
Because that way we all win.
Thank you for your leadership.
Thank you very much. Senator Champion.
Griselda Panita Potts.
My name is Griselda Pineda Ponce. I am 19 years old, and I am a student at Mankato State University. I am studying forensic science, and I am also a logistics specialist for the United States Army. I am here to speak in behalf of my support to the Senator's File 224, because I was directly affected by this issue. In 2007, my mom was pulled over and given a ticket for not having a driver's license. They gave her the option to pay it right away or do community service. She decided to do community service. Just a few days after the community service was done, officers raided our home and looked for a man we did not recognize. Their intentions were placed on finding this man. However, they asked my mom for an identification card based on the way she looked. The only identification card she had was a non-state issued ID. They weren't pleased with the ID, so they took her into their offices for further assurance that she was not related to the man being persecuted. A few minutes later, she called us from the squad car to inform us that she was not coming home. She said that they weren't police officers, but ICE officers. They weren't looking for a man, they told her, that they were coming directly for her and that they should have taken her when they pulled her over. I was 11 at that time, the second oldest from four siblings. We all just broke down crying. My little brother, who was 5 at the time, really didn't know what was going on, but he started crying because he saw us all crying, and he didn't see my mom, so we told him that she had gone to the store, but she would be back. The only comfort that we had at the time was knowing that my dad was still here. 5 years later, in 2012, my dad was pulled over on the way to driving my sister to work. He was pulled over, detained, and deported because he didn't have a driver's license. Now we were left alone. I was a junior in high school at that time. My older sister was a freshman in college. My younger brother was a sophomore in high school, and my youngest brother had just started middle school. Since my older sister depended on my dad to pay for her college, I now had the responsibility to help her pay because I was the only one with a job at that time. My sister was looking for work but found it very hard because it didn't fit her class schedules. My sister would cry almost every night. She would wake up in the middle of the night crying. She didn't cry in front of us because she tried to be strong since she was the oldest, but I knew she would cry because I could hear her at night. My brother, who was 16 at the time, lost complete focus in school, no matter how hard we pushed him and told him to keep trying in school. He had other things on his mind. He would oftentimes tell me, like, how are we going to pay for this bill? What are we going to do? So he couldn't focus in school. Eventually, he ended up dropping out of high school his senior year, and now he works full-time but regrets not getting his diploma. My youngest brother, he was 8 at that time, he left to Mexico with my parents because he was going to be a big responsibility for us, and we were trying to go to school and work at the same time, so my parents decided that it was best if he left with them. He, unlike me and my siblings, did not get the opportunity or the education we got here in the U.S. I tried calling him once in a while and speak to him in English so that he doesn't forget his homeland language. We were all affected by this differently. For me, one job wasn't enough anymore. I looked for a second and a third job while trying to balance school out. It was really hard. My senior year, I started falling behind. They had told me that I was in risk of not graduating. I didn't quit work, but I stayed up late nights working on homework. Sometimes there was a few nights where I wouldn't get sleep at all. And I did end up graduating. And that summer, after graduating, I decided that I wanted to join the Army, so I left in September 2014 to AIT training and came back 6 months after. I just got home 2 weeks ago. Over the past 3 years, I've moved at least 10 times. I don't live with any of my siblings. We're all separated. A lot of times, people ask me, why did I join the Army after the country separated my family? I can only answer by saying that my parents came to the U.S. for a better life for us. I've gotten the opportunities here that I would have never gotten anywhere else. One negative thing cannot overpower all the good things that this country has done for my family. I believe that this is a great way for me to give back for all I've been given here, and also for my parents to be able to say that their daughter is an American soldier. From one day to another, our lives were completely changed. Not having a driver's license has been the cause of separation of my families. I only wish for this to not happen to anyone else. Minnesota's my home. I love my community, and I am planning to serve my country. Today, I'm asking you to support Senator File 224, I believe this is the time for Minnesota to support my community. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your sharing your story, and thank you for being courageous and telling it. We know it was very difficult. We appreciate you. Your taking the time to help us understand. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, that's all of my testifiers. I also have, you know, representatives, as I mentioned earlier, from the Minneapolis Police Department and also from the St. Paul Police Department, from the Mexican Consulate, if there are any questions. But I think that we've answered a lot, but we stand ready to answer any other questions that you have.
All right. Anything further, members? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just a question to the last testifier. If I could just understand, you said your mom and your dad left and your younger brother, I think, went with them. I infer from that they went back to a different country, or is that correct?
Yes, Senator. They went back to Mexico with my parents, or my little brother went with them.
Okay. And
Senator Westrom.
So, Mr. Chair, just so I understand, at this time they reside there, and you and your other siblings that still are here reside in Minnesota?
Yes. My older sister, she's in college right now. One of my younger brothers, he's working full-time, and then the youngest one, he's with my parents.
Okay. Last question, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Thank you for your testimony. So are you able to have a driver's license now here? I assume maybe you were born in Minnesota here?
Or Ms. Pineda Ponce?
Yes. Me and my four siblings were all U.S. citizens.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I guess a follow-up. So the issue would have affected your parents. Those of you that are still here are able to have your driver's license because of that citizenship status.
Yes, but I'm here to speak for all the people who are still here and don't have driver's license, and I don't want like the same thing that happened to me to happen to them.
Very good. Thank you.
Yep. All right. Before I forget, I wanted to recognize the Consul General from Mexico, Mr. Alberto Fierro. Thank you for being here. Appreciate your presence and your representation of your country. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the last testifier, did I hear you say you are in the service? You're in the Army?
Yes, Senator.
And what is your rank?
I'm an E2, Senator.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you on behalf of the committee for your service.
Thank you.
All right. Anything further? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to reiterate something Senator Champion said. I have talked to some of my police chiefs, and while I think we agree that there's reform in our immigration system, what we're talking about here is public safety, and they would agree with Senator Champion that having some of the training and the rules of the road in the United States is a positive. And so I look forward to working with Senator Champion on further modifications to the bill. He's been a good partner before, and I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. Anything further? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 224? Senator Champion, do you have a motion?
I make the motion that that Senate File number 224 be recommended to pass and go to rules.
Rules.
Where it would still meet deadlines, is my understanding.
Correct. Once it gets to rules, rules doesn't the deadline requirements don't apply to the Committee on Rules, and so it will have met its first policy deadline with this motion, should it prevail, and as amended.
As amended.
Yes. All right. Anything further, members? Senator Westrom.
Do you anticipate, Senator Champion, what other committees are you intending to or needing to go through?
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, rules, and then it will go to the floor. But in between that time, I've made a commitment to Senator Pratt to make some modifications if need be.
Senator Champion, I think we'll need to make a trip through finance because of
finance.
The fiscal. Yeah,
yes.
Of the fiscal implications.
Finance as well.
Right. All right. Anything further? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee.
All right, we'll take just a brief pause to clear the room, and then we'll bring up Senator Dick. Or...
I'm working on an answer for you. We were talking about.
By clear the room, I meant actually clear the room. So please please depart and take your conversations outside. We need to get to another bill.
They're not our standard.
I know.
So I guess the clearing of the room process is going to be slow. Anyone in the room, please cease your conversations until you leave the room. We need to start the next bill. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Senator Dietzick, Senate File 1679.
My notes said good afternoon, members, but it's actually good evening, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1679 outlines insurance responsibilities for transportation network companies that provide ride sharing for a fee. People like the ease, quickness, and no cash option of these services. They view them as safe, clean, quick way to get from point A to point B. I personally like the entrepreneurial and innovative spirit that started this company. In this bill, we are not trying to stop that. We are trying to find a balance. This bill attempts to find that balance between the free market service riders want and consumer protections they are expecting. The bill does not prohibit TNC companies from doing business in Minnesota. We are simply laying out insurance requirements for doing business in Minnesota. We leave local regulations up to the local ordinances. There are three phases in a TNC product. The first phase is when the driver turns on the app saying that they are open for business and available to pick up a ride. They could be at a coffee shop waiting to see if someone requests a ride in the direction that they are going, or they could be on the road. The next phase is when they have engaged the app and agreed to pick up the passenger. Then the last phase is when the passenger is actually in the car. And we talk about these phases because we have in the bill different liability limits for each of those phases. After the driver drops the passenger off, the driver can turn the app off and be done, or they can go on, turn it back on, and go look for another ride. We had a discussion, actually a good discussion, in Commerce Committee. Since then, we actually amended the levels in that committee, and then since then, we have continued having conversations trying to determine what level is needed to protect consumers. With that, members, I have the A4 amendment, and this amendment changes the insurance requirements in Phase 1. So this is actually kind of aligns with what California has. So they've accepted the limits in California, and so we are mimicking that. We don't have a global agreement yet, but we are continuing to talk, and I think this is a good compromise. Again, it is a balance between providing a service that people want and consumer protection. Mr. Chair, members, I have with me here today is Mr. Bob Johnson from the Insurance Federation. He's going to walk us through the bill, and then I believe the Commerce Commissioner Rothman is actually on his way, and he will be available to answer questions. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Johnson.
Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll just make a couple of brief comments, and then I'll walk
through
the bill.
And pull the microphone very close. We have bad microphones in this room.
Sorry.
Thank you. I have a soft voice, so I struggle with the same thing.
All right. I will try to dial it up. So I'll make a couple of brief comments, and then I'll walk through the sections of the bill and for the committee, and I probably by then Commissioner Rothman will be here. The reason the bill is here, committee members, is that, as Commissioner Rothman will comment, and he did at the Commerce Committee, he issued a consumer advisory or alert. Many of you have probably seen that, wrote a letter to the chairs of the House and Senate Commerce Committee and the leadership, alerting the legislature, but to the consumers of this state, about the potential of a coverage gap if they have chosen to become involved. And I'll call it commercial ride-sharing activity. And that kind of advisory has been issued by half of the commissioners around this nation within their states and by the NAIC. It's the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And the reason those advisories have been issued is because in the personal auto market, for years and years, there has always been a feature in personal auto policies of a livery exclusion. So it's L-I-V-E-R-Y, a livery exclusion, is written in policies. And what it does is it excludes coverage if a consumer is using their personal auto for a commercial use. So the phrase that I will comment or describe is the commercial use of a personal asset. So the commercial use of a personal asset, the personal auto policy does not cover. The commercial use of a house, the homeowners would not cover. So with those exclusions in place and this new development, this web app-based system, if you will, of connecting people with rides, which has had explosive growth and great popularity, and we have no dispute or contention with this business model, so that's got nothing to do with that. The net effect of where the policies are today is that there's a coverage gap. So if an accident happens to an individual riding in the car, driving the car, a pedestrian, our conclusion is that because of that coverage gap, states need to pass legislation to address it. They're acting. A bill just landed yesterday on the Utah governor's desk. Many states are debating this, or if they're not, they'll be debating it shortly. So from our industry's perspective, that's the reason why, to eliminate the gap and establish clarity of the rules between the personal auto pool and then the commercial. We need the clarity of the rules. We do not have it today. And so for those reasons, Mr. Chairman and committee members, we're supporting Senate File 1679. I'll just briefly, and then however, Mr. Chairman, you want to go, we can slow down or dial it up or dial into these sections of the bill.
Mr. Johnson, I think Senator Kiffmeyer.
Just to clarify, Mr. Chairman, we're still on the amendment to the bill, correct?
Well, it hasn't yet been moved. Should we move the amendment and then walk through the bill?
I'll move the amendment.
All right. So Senator Pratt moves the A4 amendment. Senator Dietzick has already described it. Any questions on the amendment?
Yeah, I did have a – that's why I was asking.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you just – I'm looking at what you amended here. So line 328 says $1 million because of bodily injury and so on. And yet in the amendment, it's $50,000 and $100,000 and $30,000 for property damage. Now, maybe I, because it's an amendment, maybe I'm not quite getting the entire context, but I do know this, that $50,000, $100,000, and $30,000 in this day and age is not much. Car, personal injury, and all these sorts of things. So that's why I'm asking the question. So maybe you can clarify, is this indeed a drop from $1 million down to these amounts, or is there something else going on? I'm not catching here.
And Senator Kiffmeyer, also just to add, because it went kind of quickly in Senator Dietzick's presentation, this is for the, I guess there are considered to be three
phases
of service.
Yes.
For these sorts of, well, I guess in the cab industry in general. So when you're just kind of driving around looking for a fare, so that's phase one. Then when you have someone in your cab, that's
when
phase.
So when you're phase one is when you have you've turned the app on, and so you're pretty much open for business and saying I'm available to take someone a ride. You could be sitting at a coffee shop, or you could be driving around. Phase two is when you click that app on, and you've agreed to accept a passenger, and then phase three is when you actually have the passenger. And so the million is still for phases two and three. We didn't reduce that. There's been a lot of discussion on that phase one, on what is the appropriate level, because you're open for business. You've turned that app on and said, I'm open for business, but should that amount be should it be $1 million? Should it be 500? Should it be lower? You could be sitting in a coffee shop, and so you're really not, so what is that level of risk? When you're in a coffee shop, you're not out driving around. You could be sitting there having a cup of coffee, turn the app on, and then all of a sudden somebody clicks it on, and you're going, okay, I'll go pick them up. And so then you've clicked that on, and then you're into phase two. Or you could be on your way to a mall to pick somebody up, or downtown to pick somebody up and have the app on. And so that's what we've been struggling with all week.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've never heard of three-phase car insurance. So that is – and I also did not see, from what I could tell – I know you're calling it phase one, two, or three, but I could not tell. So that must be
Mr. Chairman, maybe when I walk through it, I can identify the paragraphs where those phases are.
Sure. Do we want to adopt the amendment?
And then, Mr. Chair, I'll ask Mr. Johnson. There is – so it's those limits with an additional excess of $200,000, so I'll have him explain that.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer and the committee members, as Senator Dietzick just said, this language actually is as close as it can be crafted for this bill, copies what California passed last year, and it was in this phase one. The $50,000, $100,000, $30,000 with an additional $200,000, and their law calls it excess coverage, liability coverage. So the pool of dollars in that phase one is bigger up to those total amounts, if you will. So that's what the language of the bill, this amendment does.
Very good. All right. Questions for the amendment? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Mr. Who made that motion? Oh, Senator Pratt did. That's right. Yes. Thank you. It's getting late. All right. Mr. Johnson, help us understand just in very high level what the bill provides for.
I will. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Committee members. So just on page one in the section one on the definitions, it just defines the TNC, the person who's chosen to become the driver in that activity. The plan of network, transportation network, financial responsibility, that's the plan that this bill requires TNCs to provide. And then the last definition, the participating driver, that's the personal auto policy of a driver. So we need those definitions, and then we'll go on to page two, and there's a disclosure, an important disclosure on subdivision two, two participating drivers from the TNC. about the plan and the coverages, so it's important that consumers driving are aware of the coverages and the dollar amounts. Subdivision 3 really is the operative requirement of what this new insurance will be required. And so the TNC's financial responsibility, that's the defined coverage that they're going to have to carry under this legislation. And paragraph B on that page 2 is the key paragraph on, I would describe it as phase 2 and 3. So when you connect with an individual and then when the individual is riding in a car. So as Senator Dietzick described that. And so then the bill has a series of paragraphs that are the specifics of the coverages, that, and you'll see it duplicated under both these paragraphs, B and D. And these are coverages, Mr. Chairman, that are just in our insurance laws today. So the paragraph 1 is the liability coverage. So that's the new language that Senator Dietzick in this amendment drops from $1 million to this new language. Then paragraph 2 deals with our current no-fault PIP. They're called personal injury protection, so it requires the PIP requirements under our current Minnesota law. 3 is the uninsured, underinsured, and in the bill here, this is at $1 million. And that's a mandated coverage today of all consumers have to buy in their personal auto policies. So the liability, the PIP, the uninsured, underinsured, and then on page 3, the collision and comprehensive. So that's, in Minnesota law today, that's an optional coverage with all of us as consumers. What the bill provides is that if the individual driving their personal car has chosen to buy collision and comprehensive, then the TNC policy similarly has to include it. So it's a protection for the individual. Then those are the coverages. And that those coverages will be duplicated under that paragraph B and then also under paragraph D. So I won't repeat the description because it's the same descriptions in terms of the coverage amounts. But paragraph D covers that phase one, if you will, the application on and the person is not in the car. So then there are a series of clauses about a duty to defend. So now these are, I would describe to them as kind of standard clauses that you'll see in liability policies. A duty to defend. On page 3, lines 3.6 to 3.9, is real important language in the bill, and as these bills have been passed around the country, that recognizes this new required coverage can be met by either a TNC policy or the personal auto policy or some combination of them, because new products are developing, and we want to recognize and keep that open for products to develop. So that's paragraph C on page 3. Then, again, I said I won't repeat those coverage amounts under D, except that the bill, as it comes to the committee, is at $1 million. It's at $1 million at phase 2 and 3 and the lower amount on phase 1. Then, leaving the coverages, then I would go to page 4 and subdivision 4, the participating driver's motor vehicle insurance. And this is the section that draws a bright line in terms of keeping out of the personal auto policies this commercial driving risk. And so that's really what the operative language is in subdivision 4. That's language that's found in states that are passing this legislation. That's one of the key provisions that you'll find California law has. I call it a bright line between the commercial risk and then the personal driving pool risk. Then it ends. I'll just skip to there's a cooperation clause in terms of a statutory requirement that if a claim arises that we want to have statutory requirement of the cooperation between the TNC, the driver, and the insurer. So we want to make sure there's communication and transparency in that. Then subdivision 6 actually has a proof of insurance requirement that the driver should have proof of insurance in the car. So if somebody's in the car, they have to have with them, and if somebody asks a question, they'd have a card that says what the coverages are. And with that, Mr. Chairman, the bill ends on the very last page by having a indemnification and subrogation rights. This is a paragraph that gives a kind of an ultimate protection if there aren't other coverages available, than our auto-assigned claims plan. We have another area of Minnesota insurance code that if there's an accident and there's no coverages available, the state has a protection, an auto-assigned claims bureau that actually will kick in and pay the claim of the individual. And this would give the auto claim facility a right of subrogation against a transportation network company. So those are the features of the bill. It really is, it's an insurance coverage requirement bill with the definitions of those required coverages, Mr. Chairman. So I'd be happy to stand for questions.
And subrogation is to recover the
losses that have been paid out, correct, Mr. Chairman, by the Auto Claims Bureau.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Dietzick, anything further?
Pardon me?
Anything further from you?
No, I think this is it has been a work in progress. We've had a lot of conversations. I think some of the committee members on your committee have participated in that, and I think this is, we're getting to a bill that hopefully is a global agreement that will provide consumers protection that they are expecting.
So you have Commissioner Rothman here. Commissioner Rothman, were you wanting to share thoughts with us? All right. Thanks. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you and the committee members for taking up the bill and Senator Dietzick for this important issue and to address it. I have a number of talking points, but I'll just tell you a few things off the top of my head. I know you have other testifiers.
We do have your letter in our packet as well, so thank you for
I'll just highlight a few things and the importance of this. And, back in May of last year, it came to my attention that a young child of 6 years old named Sophia Liu was run over and killed and her family injured in an incident in San Francisco, and I think you all know about that. And as this played out among the insurance commissioners around the country, I and others put out a notice to consumers, riders, and drivers to call attention to the gap in insurance that is potentially there and make sure that people understood that. And then in December, I sent a letter to the chairs of the Commerce Committees in both houses and explained the situation and said, well, this is something that should be taken up and be addressed. From my perspective, it's important to know that the advance of technology, the opportunities of companies to have jobs, opportunities to grow, and economic activity is very important. And then the question is there a balance? And from my perspective, that the gap in insurance is really the focus of the department and my concern. And I think this bill addresses it. I know there's a variety of other questions and issues that are out there, but I just want to, again, point that out. I'm happy to answer any questions, working with all the parties to help sort through this, and want to just thank everybody again for addressing it.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner.
Yep.
Questions, members? I have Mike White and Joel Carlson, who have requested the opportunity to testify. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Joel Carlson, I'm here on behalf of Uber Technologies, and I'm probably going to have Mr. White provide some kind of opening comments, and I want to address just some specifics in the bill. This bill gives us significant concern, and we appreciate the work that's been done, but it's not in a package yet that we can give our blessing to.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Carlson, could you move the mic
closer, please? Sorry, Senator Rest.
All right. Mr. White.
Yes. Good evening, Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you very much for taking some time to hear my testimony today. My name is Michael White, and I'm the general manager for Uber in the Midwest. And I just want to express my grave concerns and opposition to the bill as presented to you today. Uber has operated in Minnesota for about 2.5 years. And since that time, since entering the market, we've been really embraced by the members of the state. And our business has grown quickly as we've met a real need in the two cities where we operate, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, both in providing rides for individuals who need them in a reliable and safe and economical way, and providing economic opportunity for drivers who go through our vetting process, the safety qualification process, and get access to our platform to provide these rides. And it's really been a benefit, and it's been really fantastic to be a part of the growth of this business and the opportunity for these entrepreneurs to make money using our platform. Through that time, we've worked closely with the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis to develop local regulations that have really addressed not only insurance questions, but also the registration and regulatory requirements for operating within those municipalities. And it was a long process. It took a few months to work through all the different stakeholders, whether they be local officials, insurance providers, the different transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft, and local constituents. And we got to a really strong place that has really answered the questions that have been raised by the previous testifiers in all of the cities where we currently operate. Our opposition to this bill is that this bill is far-reaching. It goes way beyond the requirements of the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, but also beyond the requirements that are in any other legislation within the country. This is truly a type of legislation that truly feels like a target has been put on transportation network companies backed by the insurance companies to take on a responsibility that is far in excess of what is asked of any other transportation companies or similar businesses within the state. And I'd like to address just a few of those items in the bill. I think one thing that's worth noting up front is that there's definitely a very sad story mentioned earlier about a girl named Sophia Liu in San Francisco who was struck by a driver who had logged onto the app in what was called period one. So he had made himself available for ride, but actually wasn't providing commercial transportation at that time. Very unfortunate incident. He struck this child and the family, and the child was killed. The mother was injured. But the truth of that incident is that there was insurance coverage that applied, and the family was paid up to the limits of that insurance. So there was no gap that occurred then. There is no gap that is in place now, and there certainly is none in the state of Minnesota under the regulations that are in place with Minneapolis and St. Paul. So it's actually unfortunate that this story keeps being used as an example of something that simply isn't true. My heart goes out to that family as an individual who has a 14-month-old myself, can definitely relate to how really awful that would be. And the family has entered into litigation with Uber for additional liability, but there is no gap in insurance in that case, and there was no that was covered as anybody who might strike somebody in a fortunate incident like that. So I just want to disqualify that up front, because that story seems to keep coming up, and it's really just not an example of what it is proposed to be. So going to the bill specifically, there's a few areas that are of critical concern. One of them is the amount of uninsured and underinsured coverage that's required in this bill. Within the state of Minnesota, everybody, whether they be an individual, a taxi, or a limousine driver, has to carry $50,000 of uninsured underinsured coverage. This bill would cause TNCs, and exclusively TNCs, coverage of $1 million. So that's a huge amount of additional coverage here that has not yet been explained to me why there's a difference or why there'd be any requirement here to have $1 million of uninsured, underinsured coverage for transportation network companies and only $50,000 of coverage for anyone else. Again, it feels like this is tarring TNCs for additional coverage that isn't really expected of anyone else. There's also a requirement in this bill for the transportation network companies to provide comprehensive and collision insurance. Now, comprehensive and collision insurance are coverages that an individual carries on their own vehicle. They're not a public safety issue. It's not a question of whether somebody could get injured and they get paid out. These are optional coverages in every state in the union and in the state of Minnesota, and they're not required for anyone to provide in any statute here. So again, this bill would require transportation network companies to provide comprehensive and collision insurance on their driver partners' vehicles, even if that driver has not paid for or doesn't even have the coverage themselves. If they'd had it at one time and canceled it, the transportation network companies are still responsible for providing that coverage. This is a step well beyond any company. There's nowhere else in the country does a bill exist at the city or state level that requires comprehensive and collision insurance to be provided by a transportation network company. Again, this is a large step beyond the coverages that are required in the state or in any other state or municipality in the country. There's also a concern in this bill about surplus lines insurance. So surplus lines insurance is a type of insurance that covers kind of new types of markets. And transportation network companies are very much on the front end of new developments. This bill does not allow the current transportation network companies who have innovated and developed insurance models that can address the different phases of insurance through a very through a strong history over the past years to be able to use those current providers in the state of Minnesota. So that's also obviously a grave concern to us, where we've developed these relationships and developed these policies, to be excluded from being able to use those in the state. It certainly caused us issues with trying to even provide this coverage within the state of Minnesota. That's also a major concern for us. There's also an issue here around consumer protection. This bill excludes any coverage that a driver has that doesn't specifically provide for a coverage for transportation network company operations. So, for example, if somebody has their own coverage at a higher limit than is what required here, that person would not be able to take advantage of that coverage because it would be specifically excluded. Now, there's a point made about a livery exclusion. Even if a driver had their own commercial policy, they go out, they buy a policy that specifically covers vehicle for hire operations. That policy, unless it specifically had an amendment that acknowledged transportation network company operations, would also be excluded. So a person thinking that they have commercial insurance would actually not be able to get that insurance either. They would have to go to the transportation network company. That's an adjustment in the policy terms with an individual happening outside of the contract with that individual. And that's obviously a big consumer protection concern for us, that somebody might have a policy saying one thing and have to look to legislation in St. Paul to know if that actually coverage is going to apply or not. So that's also a major concern for us. And it also is a concern that an amendment in the Commerce Committee actually excluded other transportation providers who use apps like Uber and Lyft do from the requirements of this bill. So there are other companies like taxis who have developed apps that provide the same type of experience. They've been explicitly excluded from this language by an amendment in the Commerce Committee to not have to provide these insurance coverages. And that's certainly a question of fairness when you're excluding an individual who's doing a very similar thing with an app from having to provide these same coverages. So with that, I just express my grave concerns with this. This type of complex legislation takes time. It needs some more review. As an example from St. Paul, Minneapolis, that took months to negotiate. This is moving at a very rapid and aggressive pace. And frankly, there's not an issue in the state of Minnesota right now. The state of Minnesota has the regulations in place with the cities where we operate. This should slow down so we can get this right. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Senator Kent and members. I think Mr. White laid out the concerns nicely. A number of these are legal issues that I think are maybe best addressed in the Judiciary Committee about when your policy is covered, when it's excluded, when you statutorily are eliminating someone's coverage. As an example, on Subdivision 4, on page 4, in paragraph A, it basically says that you have no coverage once your application is on, whether or not you're engaged in transportation services. And one of the drivers who testified in the other body said what he does is he works at home, and he has his Uber application phone by his desk, and he works at his computer. And if there's a request for a ride, he'll consider if he wants to do it or not. And then if he does, and as soon as he touches that phone and accepts that ride, he's covered by $1 million liability policy. Even when he has the app on, he's covered under Minneapolis and St. Paul's ordinance. He's covered by the 50-130 policy that you just adopted into this bill. But what this bill does is, it, as long as he has that app on, whether he's in the car or not, whether his spouse is driving the car or not while he's sitting at home, they lose all of their insurance coverage under how Subdivision 4, Paragraph A operates. We think that goes too far. This is policies that you've paid for that you should have the right to access given circumstances. This flatly says it is not covered. And we think that goes too far. Likewise, on the issue with comprehensive and collision, which isn't required in any state relative to our own motor vehicles or any TNC, this says that I, as an insurance company, can collect the premium for a comprehensive loss or a collision loss But if I happen to have that app on, I don't have to pay. I can transfer that cost to the TNC. That's not done anywhere. So you're able to collect a full premium from your insured. But if he happens to have that phone on, whether he's driving or not, that coverage is, by statute, is precluded from being paid. We think that that just goes too far. There are a number of issues in this bill that are complicated, that it's taken us a little bit of time, quite frankly, to figure out. We first saw this bill on Thursday when it was introduced. It's now a week away, and we've had a number of suggestions and changes already. We think it has a long way to go before we get to a model that will work for companies to thrive and succeed and provide the type of protection that all TNCs want to provide, not just for their drivers, but more importantly for their passengers. So we would urge caution, Madam Chair and members. You know, the $1 million uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage, they said, yep, it's required of everybody, and it is. Senator Kent knows I've long complained about the level of coverage that we have. The level of coverage in Minnesota for uninsured and underinsured coverage is $25,000 and $50,000. It has been that same level since 1974. It has never been raised. I think that it is extremely low, but I think it is also unfair to just say now with this new model, we're going to now impose upon this company a new requirement that would not be imposed on any other driver, that would be imposed on any taxi company, any commercial vehicle would not have that level of coverage. An 80,000-pound commercial truck in Minnesota driving on our roads today has insurance limits of $100,000 and $300,000 per accident. This far exceeds what you impose on commercial motor vehicles. And we just think it goes too far and needs to be seriously addressed. What is the risk that we're trying to insure against? How do we handle other motor vehicles? And what are we doing to this model if we impose these requirements, which we think far exceed anything else that's been imposed across the country, and for sure not in Minneapolis and St. Paul? And I was responsible for negotiating those agreements with Minneapolis and St. Paul, and they were very cautious. They were one of the first ones in the country to say, as soon as the application's on, there's not going to be any question about coverage. The TNC is going to provide that coverage. That's what we have in Minnesota right now. And when you accept work and you're doing commercial work, not only do you have that coverage, it jumps up to $1 million liability policy, and we think that's appropriate. Minnesota was one of the first states to do that. It was patterned after the law in Colorado, which was the first state to adopt such a regulation. And we think that that as a model is something that we can work off of. This one just isn't quite there yet, Madam Chair and members. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Peterson, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Carlson, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Mr. White. Mr. Michael White.
How could I have forgot that? Yeah. Mr. White, one question I have is kind of relation to the income and in relation to what a cost of the policy might be to provide the coverage that you have here. Are you comfortable sharing what the average income of one of your drivers is in the Midwest at this point? Or do you know what that is? Or
so, Madam Chair, Mr. White. Senator Pearson, the earnings vary. So what's unique about our model, and actually what makes it so successful, is the flexibility of the drivers to decide how much or how little they'd like to use the service. In transportation, there's a large variance in the type of demand you experience. When there's a professional football game, you're going to have a very different amount of demand than a Tuesday afternoon. And so drivers use our platform on a very flexible basis. On average, we did a study in California about the amount of time that a driver is spending on the system is about 4 hours a week. But some may use it a lot more, and some may use it less. So their earnings will vary tremendously based on how much time they're spending on the system. But that plays to the advantage of when there's high demand, more drivers will come out. They'll be able to meet that higher level of demand, and you can have reliability even at those times of spikes in demand.
Senator Peterson.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. White, have you done any research on what a policy would cost based on the coverage that's in this bill on a monthly premium basis, or?
Mr. White, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, We kicked that very question around yesterday, and as we've been trying in the last week to work through the pieces of the bill, we haven't gotten to that component yet, but it's something that we're trying to develop right now so that you can know what the economic impact is on these level of coverages. And, you know, one of the things that people who use the service, I'm not that hip, but my daughter does, and when she has to go from the Cathedral Hill to meet me at the Xcel Energy Center and she takes an Uber, it's $5. And what is that $5 cost going to be when you've now layered on these level of coverages? How much is that going to impact the consumer? Because that's where it's going to get passed on to, and as is many insurance costs. So we're trying to get to that answer, Senator Peterson, but we're not there yet.
So, Madam Senator Chair, is that something Senator Dietzick or Mr. Johnson would be able to
I'm gonna
answer
turn over
at
to Mr.
this
Johnson.
Point?
I know we were asking that, too. Okay.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson. I have some numbers, but I would comment that Uber and other TNCs have been operating at these million-dollar coverage levels in Colorado and Kentucky and Washington, D.C. and Illinois, California and Virginia for some time. So there's been a period of time there is some coverages and costs that they have, whether they have them here tonight. But I've got some numbers. It's not for this to give the committee an idea. If you went to an independent agent in Minnesota, you're trying to buy some commercial coverages at some of these dollar amounts if you're a small business owner. For $250,000/$500,000 of liability coverage, $364 for 6 months. So this would be a small business owner. So if you were a bigger buyer, you would likely be able to get some of these numbers down. $100,000, $300,000 of liability, $357. So you'll see the gradation of premium. It doesn't jump. I actually didn't get the $1 million of coverage, but it would likely not be that many dollars above that number I gave. $50,000, $100,000, $334 for 6 months. So if you got a year's worth, just double each of those numbers. So you're talking about $700 a year for $250,000, $500,000. And as we have chatted with and looked at this, somebody buying a commercial auto policy, so if you were a small taxi cab or a commercial auto policy, the price would be around $700 a year. So that's kind of a ballpark that we looked at. But I think those numbers are real numbers that an independent agent today would give you if you were looking for some quotes. It'd have to be tailored, and depending on your business, it can change some, but at least it gives you some relativities of the dollars.
And
okay, thank you.
Madam Chair and members.
Mr. Carlson.
Well, it is accurate that we do carry $1 million coverage right now in periods two and periods three. No one that, I don't want to say no one, the underinsured and uninsured and underinsured coverage at $1 million is not the case in other jurisdictions. So let's make sure that we use that number. Let's make sure we know where it applies, and it certainly doesn't apply in that area. Let's make sure that we're clear about that. And if it's $364 every 6 months, and you have 2,000 drivers driving part-time over the year, you've just added a $1.5 million of cost onto this service just for the $250, $500 that he just told us. That doesn't even count the comprehensive, the collision, and the $1 million UIM. So you're talking about a substantial cost for what is in most instances a part-time kind of operation, and I think that is significant.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, just to comment, it is important because I'm reading off of a chart prepared by Uber, so this is not my chart, this is their chart, and the Virginia law, which has been passed, has uninsured, underinsured at $1 million. So there is a state law, and I do not know whether Uber and the TNC supported that law, but this is their chart, not mine, and it says $1 million on the UIM coverage requirement.
Which, Madam Chair, takes effect in July of 2016, and we haven't even begun to rate it yet. So I appreciate that. I know that it's there. And I didn't say no one had it. But it isn't in place yet, and we haven't rated it. And there's a long way between now and that time, and that legislation is still under discussion with legislators in Virginia. So I don't want to say that that's the ending point for that one.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Kiffmeyer, did you have a question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was doing some Googling and checking things out. So I heard when you mentioned the list of states, one of the ones that I've here is Utah. So I took a quick look at Utah. It seemed like there's a lot of similarity to this one. Could you maybe, do you have, what about Utah?
Mr. Carlson or Mr. White?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't have all the details of every state at my fingertips. I know that that in Utah there's been a lot of legislative action. There's actually legislation in place and moving around in many different states, in most states actually around the country right now where this is being considered. So unfortunately I don't have the details on that specific state. There's certainly other examples of other states with much lower or different coverages. What I would say as a standard of comparison is what is expectation in Minnesota of other people who are doing similar things, and then how does this compare to that, and then is there a reason for there to be 20 times of difference in new legislation as compared to what's required of somebody else on the same streets in the same cities within Minnesota. So I don't know the answer to that, but I think I would ask for the context around this state.
And Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Carlson.
My recollection is that the Utah law passed within like the last week, right at the end of their session, and it isn't one that I have looked at. It's just very recent. But I will go there. It wasn't one that was in our matrix before. I think it just passed in the very final days of their session within the last week.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, just to mention, it does have from what I can see here, the liability, $1 million, and then the 5,130. And so it kind of struck me that it was very, very similar to what's here. And that is not unusual that one state does this and that there tends to be a follow-through in other states as well. But did so, since it just passed last week, did Uber take a position for or against the Utah one?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Carlson,
and members, I don't think that we're arm wrestling over where some of these coverages apply, like comprehensive and like the high UIM coverages. I don't think with the amendment that was added today, which I saw when I walked in the room, the 5,130, there's not an opposition to that in period one. We're fine with that. We're fine with the $1 million coverage in periods two and three, which you're reading from Utah. It's the other components of this bill that give us the most concern. It isn't the limits that are in the bill now in those periods. It's the additional coverage, the comprehensive, the very high underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage that we're struggling with because of the inequity with the rest of our transportation system, and putting that level of cost and liability on part-time operators just seems excessive given what we know is in place for other motorists.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
So
Senator Peterson.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So Senator Dietzick, so what's your position on the higher? Is it just you believe that consumers need the ability to be able to get more money in the event that there's some type of accident, or why would you want to deviate from what the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul are doing now with their other transportation companies?
Senator, are you Dietzick? Talking for period? Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you, Senator Peterson, you're talking for period one, or what are you?
Yes, for period one.
For period one, we're kind of similar to what they are, Minneapolis and St. Paul did for period one, and then we're asking for that 200 because we just want to make sure the excess 200, we're kind of copying what California did and looking at just to make sure there is coverage. There was some concern that we felt, and in talking to others, that Minneapolis and St. Paul were on the lower end, and so we were just trying to find compromise in there of what would be down from a million, what would be a good compromise number in that period one.
So then, Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, so in regards to that coverage, and that's what's available to somebody that would be happen to be, involved in the accident, basically, is that that's why we have those numbers there? You just want those higher?
Senator Dietzick.
So could you explain that again? Sorry, Madam Chair.
Well, unless I'm getting a couple areas mixed up here, Madam Chair and Senator Dietzick, I just thought I heard Mr. Carlson talk about rates or coverages that is significantly higher than Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so my question is, why do you want higher rates than those cities? Is it so that if there's an accident, that whoever may be injured has available to those dollars, because certainly there's a cost to that, certainly a cost to the operators. So I'm wondering who benefits from having the higher rates.
It was totally a discussion on consumer protection. Do we feel that people are protected enough? I think we agree with the Minneapolis numbers on periods 2 and 3. We just had concerns on the phrase one. If we took similar numbers to in the first thing and then just added the excess coverage on what California did so that there is additional money there if needed. It's not looking to benefit somebody, but if somebody gets in an accident, medical costs can be quite high, and especially if, I hate to say it, if they don't die, they can be high. And so we are just trying to, it's consumer protection. We want to make sure the public is protected. So we're not trying to run the TNCs out. We're not trying to, create a overly burdensome. We are just looking for what is the best coverage to make sure our consumers are protected. And quite frankly, I have a lot of users in my district that use this, so I just want them protected.
Sure.
Senator Peterson.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, do you have plans, in your Senate office to take this coverage to other transportation companies then? Or why are we singling out Uber to pay higher rates or have higher coverage than any other cab company or, quite frankly, any limo company that costs significantly more for a ride to the airport, for example? And
I think the limos, if you go to the airport, I think they have to have 1.5. I think we increased that last year to 1.5 million. I think the cab companies, if you go to the airport, have 100, 600, 100 coverage. And so I think they are not, if you're going, especially if you're going to the airport, I think they are comparable. I don't think they are completely out of whack.
Senator Jensen, did you want to address this point?
Well, Madam Chair, and when we had this discussion in the Commerce Committee, we ended at $1 million in the first phase, and that's where we felt it protected not only the consumer but the drivers too, because the situation that happened out in San Francisco, yes, they had personal auto insurance, but it didn't go high enough. The limits were so low that although they had personal auto insurance, it didn't cover that kind of a risk. So what we came to in the Commerce Committee is, if you are open for business and you're saying that you're going to do business, whether you're in a coffee shop or whatever, however that happens, the way that insurance works is you're rated based on your exposure to risk. So when you get an automobile policy yourself, they ask you, do you commute? And then they ask you, how many miles do you drive? And you're rated on even that because you have more exposure to risk because of how far you drive. And they ask you how many miles you drive in a year. So that's on your personal auto policy. It's not out of line to ask a commercial business to make sure, we're not asking that in this. We're saying we just want to make sure that everybody understands what the coverage is, including the consumer and the driver, so that they're protected. And I am also concerned about agents. When we're looking at a kind of a policy and a model where you have a personal policy that's overridden by a commercial policy and also by another company, there has to be absolute understanding. This bright line that he's talking about is what's important here, because we won't know what happens until the time of a claim. And when a claim comes in, there might be confusion on when does which policy pick up. So, Senator Kiffmeyer, your question about having a turn on, blink off, it's because there are different policies affected in that one vehicle in this commercial situation. They're relying on personal auto insurance to cover their personal, and then somehow figure out when does the commercial policy start, and then is it enough coverage? Are we protecting everyone in the situation? And I can tell you, in the Commerce Committee, we decided that if you're open for business and you click that on, you are on a commercial situation and that you should have $1 million at that level. Now, I understand there's some conversation going on around that, and we might land on that. But the absolute thing that we're trying to do is make sure that at a time of a claim, the unfortunate situation where there's an accident, everybody knows, including the owner, which coverage covers, what limits do you need, and if you have to go to your personal agent, they knew what coverage you have and what exposure to risk you had at the time that you took out your personal insurance, too. So it would be my choice to stay at $1 million. I understand, you know, we're looking at going lower, and I'm okay with that, and I understand, Senator Dietzick, you've done a lot of work on this, and I know you're taking everything into consideration. So I hope that we can at least pass this out with the levels that have been agreed to and amended on here, but it's important to everybody across the Minnesota, not just the states, the places they're in now, we have to look out for Minnesota and apply these standards so that it's very clear what we expect.
And Senator Peterson, did you want to follow up?
Yeah, so Madam Chair, so Mr. Carlson or White or Senator Dietzick, are they the same? Are the coverages the same for Uber right now at each level as they are for a cab company or limo company?
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair. Senator Peterson, no. Right now, for uninsured, underinsured coverages, this requires $1 million of coverage, and everybody else on the road in the state of Minnesota is only required to carry $50,000. So that's a 20 times difference.
All right, thank you.
There's also, if I may, Madam Chair,
yep.
There's also a requirement here for TMCs to provide comprehensive and collision insurance, which is an optional coverage for everyone else who drives on the road, and TMCs would be required to provide that as well, even if the driver's own comprehensive and collision insurance has been canceled or has gone out of coverage for whatever reason. So there's a number of issues, I think, here in equity. Another aspect that I mentioned in my testimony is that other transportation providers who are using an app in a very similar way, who would otherwise be included in this, are excluded without explanation from the requirements of this coverage. So if a taxi, for example, in Minneapolis were both making themselves available to pick up a street hail, so they're watching for a street hail, and they had an app in their vehicle and trying to watch for a notification there, arguably even more distracted at this time than a transportation network company would, they actually are not required to follow any of these requirements. They would not have to have uninsured, underinsured coverages at these levels. They are excluded from the draft that we are considering today. So there's not equity in this draft.
Madam Chair, members, what he's
Mr.
talking
Carlson.
About is on page 1, line 1.3. In the Commerce Committee, they inserted the word primarily at the request of the cab companies so that it wouldn't pick them up because they have other ways of picking up customers, whether it's on the street or not. That's the operative word that they used in the Commerce Committee to exclude them and require these higher coverages on the part-time TNC drivers. I did want to make one other point that because it came up, Uber does not operate at the airport. They have their own set of regulations, and we don't. UberX ride sharing is not authorized at the airport, so we don't operate there currently.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, I'm really trying to figure out what the jurisdiction of this committee is. I mean,
exactly.
We are hearing a repeat, and I happen to be in the room waiting for something else, of what it was in the Commerce Committee. We don't have jurisdiction over insurance.
No.
We have jurisdiction, in my mind, over the public safety aspects of, and as a transportation company. And I don't find it enlightening to get into the minutiae of the insurance aspects. And I know someone like Senator Jensen just finds it fascinating. Just like I do taxes. But, you know, there are just some things that have gone way beyond the scope of this committee. And I think unless there are any other testifiers.
Thank you.
What's the number on this bill?
1679.
What?
Serve it up.
Way to go, Senator.
I move that Senate File 1679, as amended, be recommended to pass. And does it need a referral to another committee?
Judiciary.
It will be going to Judiciary.
And that it be referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
And motion taken. So, Senator Rest, members, we do have two member additional testifiers who had wanted to briefly comment on
there
the
other
two
other testifiers, and I think we should hear from them and then get to a vote.
The motion.
So, Madam Chair, yeah, to Senator that point, Peterson. While they're coming up, I mean, sure, somebody here should be able to offer some insight into how this bill ended up here. You know, I asked that question of Senator Dibble just a day or two ago, and I think he responded it was up to the chair and the author and Senator Pappas. So, you know, Senator Rest, I mean, my responsibility is to vote for things. I'm trying to find out why this company is getting treated differently than a cab company. And they are.
Now that, Madam Chair and Senator Rest, that part I understand. But the minutiae of the insurance coverage
Commerce.
And what all the laws are in other states, that doesn't help me make the decision. It looks like the question that you're answering, that asking is there's something else out there, and I just think we need to move it along.
Point taken, yes. Senator.
Or
Rest.
Not, or all defeat right. it one way or the
so
other.
So let's have if we could have is it Che Eisenman and Barbie Barkley, please come to the table for a brief testimony. Ms. Eisenman?
Hi there.
Hi. Please introduce yourself.
All right. My name is Shay Eisenman. I started driving a cab about 5.5 years ago, and now I am a current limo driver. I have a business that I operate out of St. Paul here at Cathedral Hill. I'm used to my audience being behind my back, so I feel socially awkward facing you. I'm much more charming if you were behind me, I swear.
You're doing great.
One thing I've observed in this industry is that worst-case scenarios can happen. And that's why insurance exists. It's also an industry that cannot babysit itself, and it needs some guidance and some structure. We drive human lives, and we drive around human lives. We pass them on the street, we pass them in other cars, and we have them in our back seat. And so I know I used to be a cab, but now I'm a limo. I have $1.5 million coverage, and I have to have that in order to operate at MSP Airport. So that is my coverage. It's 24/7. So that's also the case as well. Let's see. One thing I guess that I'd like to point out is that I actually know quite a few Uber drivers, both what I call good Uber and bad Uber. I call good Uber being Uber Black and Uber SUV, which would be a licensed, legal, commercial vehicle that has commercial insurance. And I also know Uber drivers who are Uber X. And Uber X is somebody in their personal car and personal auto insurance operating a commercial vehicle under the guise of ride sharing. And a lot of my friends who are Uber X drivers are starting to take out ride sharing insurance or licensing their cars as limos and getting limo insurance because they are concerned about protecting the investment, which is their car, and they're concerned also about, you know, should something happen, where are they going to be left in the shuffle? Is Uber going to have their back? Is Uber's insurance going to have their back? Is their insurance company going to have their back? There's a lot of concerns there. And so I'm starting to see more and more drivers seek out insurance on their own. And in Minnesota, you can get ride-sharing insurance now. It's slightly more than limo insurance, but slightly less than taxi insurance. And the last thing I'd like to just address really quickly is when an Uber driver has an app in their car, the only time they're engaged in the app is not just when they're offered a ping or a ride, but oftentimes that phone will show, it's called a heat map, it'll show surging across the city. So it'll say Dinkytown is surging at 2.5, or you know, 2.5 times you know the fare, or St. Paul is at 5 times the fare. And so those drivers are constantly monitoring that surge to figure out where in the city they should be so they can make the most money. So they are watching that phone more than just when they're being offered a ride. So I just wanted to clarify that. Basically, the way I see it is that if myself as a small local operator can afford to be commercially insured to protect both my passengers, the people in cars around me, and the people on the street. I think a $40 billion company can as well. I think the technology of Uber is fantastic. The concept, to this day, for the most part, the Uber experience far exceeds the taxi experience, and I say that knowing that there are very good taxi drivers in this city and taxi companies that are trying to do a good job. Overall, the experience can be better. So it's not that we don't want Uber to be here. We just would like them to be properly insured. So I really appreciate you taking my time. I have a flight landing in about 20 minutes, and I have a driver waiting at the curb to take me back to my car so I can go get a customer. So I'll hand it off to Bambi, and thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Eisman.
Thank you.
Ms. Barkley, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you so much. My name is Bambi Barkley. I drive for Blue and White ABC. I own a car there. I've been driving cab for about 6 years now, and all along the way, you know, you make an investment in the safety and security of the community that you work in. So when I go to the city to get my background checked to make sure that I'm not a criminal or a felon or have any outstanding warrants, that's me investing in the community, saying that I'm operating safely. When I pay my money for the license that allows me to drive a cab, that's me investing in the community, you know, for the security of the people that I drive and the security of the people around me. When I pay for my vehicle to be inspected, which I do, that's me investing in this business for the safety and the security of the people that I serve. And mostly, when I write out my check every month for $600 a month for my taxi cab insurance, that is me investing in the safety and security of the people that I serve. My car is covered 24/7 in every situation. If I am at the proverbial coffee shop, my car is covered. If I am asleep in my bed, my car is covered. If I'm driving a customer, my car is covered. If I'm looking for a customer, my car is covered. If I'm playing solitaire on my phone, my car is covered. My car is covered 24/7, and that's the requirement for me as a cab driver. And all I think us in the cab industry want is for fairness to exist and for everybody to have to compete at the same level and require the same level of safety and security for the community that they are wishing to serve and the community that they're wishing to operate in. And, you know, I am an independent small businesswoman. I own one car, not a company. I own one car. I make my living, and I'm able to keep my business afloat and still write out that check every month for $600 for complete comprehensive insurance. And if I can do it as an individual small businesswoman, again, a multinational, multi-billion dollar corporation should at least be required or able to provide the same level of safety and security for the community that they're serving that I am providing. In addition, I'm part of a network of local small businesses. Every single cab driver that you interact with is a small business person. They're an independent contractor. They're part of this community. They're paying taxes in this community. They're paying mortgages and property taxes in this community. Same with the cab companies. These are local companies that are paying taxes here in this community, and the money stays here. We are invested here in a way that this large, well-funded company from California, I don't know where they're from, you know, is not at all invested and has apparently been very clear about not wanting to invest as much as we do.
Thank you. Yeah. Senator Dietzick, did you have some concluding comments?
Thank you, members, for hearing this bill. This has been a work in progress, and I think we, as I said, we'll be going to judiciary next week, and I understand that there are some language concerns, and I think we will attempt to wordsmith those. I know judiciary has a habit of doing that, so I'm sure we will. So I just ask for your support.
Thank you.
I renew my notion, Madam Chair.
Yes, and we're waiting for Chair Dibble to return momentarily. So if we can do that, that would be
sure.
Great.
Walk on. Senator Peterson will help us out.
Maybe you can tell us who brought this bill.
Anybody got no good jokes?
Get approval. Can't we just? Do we need them?
Here he comes.
You want to lay it on the table? Just
kidding. Madam Chair, just while we're waiting,
here he is.
I think to Senator Peterson and Senator Rust, you know, this is the Public Safety Committee, and while we talked about the insurance aspect in commerce, it's not unusual for us to talk about proof of insurance. And I think when we heard the Commissioner and Mr. Johnson talk, what we're talking about is a lack of proof of insurance during any phase of that. And I agree with you, Senator Rust, that is important. I'm still confused as to why if I think of a taxi as an on-call, on-demand, and a limo is prearranged, I still am having a hard time understanding why Uber isn't a limo and at the limo rates. But I appreciate Senator Dietzick, you know, working with it. I don't know that the model is as unique as the owners, as the companies would say they are.
All right, members. With that, Senator Rust renews her motion that Senate file number 1679, as amended, be passed and referred to judiciary. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Anything else?
No.
See everybody tomorrow morning. Meeting is adjourned.
All right. We'll be in at 11 tomorrow, members.
11.
Thank you.
For
107.
107.